Good afternoon, Sean McAuliffe. It's a pleasure to have you on the Last Post interview, and we're here to talk about your new book, Tripping Over Yourself. If you'll just excuse for a moment, it says, comedy has been Sean McAuliffe's guiding light, his refuge, his passion, his passport, his life buoy, his drug, his mask, his means, his end, his self. But it's not everything. And you do let us into a bit of your life in this book, Sean.
I do, but I think it's important. I wanted to talk about comedy, obviously. That was the driving motivator for me. But I found when I started writing the book that it didn't have any context. There's no real reason for the audience who was reading the book to go, well, why is he interested in it? Why is it so important to him? So I had to paint a bit of a picture of my real life outside of being on television, which I've never done before. So it was quite a challenge for me to do that, because I'm not a stand-up comedian and I don't usually fold my personal life into my material. So no. it's been a whole new experience for me. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, you make note of that in the book, and indeed we start off, strangely enough, at the beginning, 1962, at the Ashford Hospital on Anzac Highway. And being an Adelaidean, I know that hospital very well. And as you note, I think everything is not too far away in Adelaide. Maybe that explains the impatience of Adelaide drivers, Sean.
It might well be, yes. I notice every time I go back, which is every Christmas, because Mum and Dad are still around, they're still there. Whenever I go back, you travel 100 metres along the road and there's a set of traffic lights. And then another 100 metres and there's another set of traffic lights. But despite that, everything is only half an hour away.
Yeah, that's incredible. I made note of that once myself, that very same point about the traffic lights. Your mother's upbringing, I guess, was important in helping shape her family attitudes, and your father's attitude too. How much, and upbringing, how much was your father's memories of the war of interest to you, Sean, growing up?
Well, had he shared them with me, that would have been enormously interesting. You know, one of my complaints about growing up in Adelaide was that it was just, in our house, just a bit dull. It was just a bit dull, and I think I retreated into my head to make things a bit more exciting. But the reality was, as I was to discover much later, was that my father had a very interesting life in Malta when he was growing up, because, of course, this is during the Second World War. And we have, the Italians and then the Germans dropping bombs down my father's street. That would have been fascinating, but he never shared any of that with me. I think it was a bit too traumatic for him, so he just wanted to provide a very safe environment for his children. He was handing us the reassuring dullness of life without bombs and without not having enough food, thinking that was the great gift, which of course it was. But and much later on, as an adult, I found out about his very exciting life. But I suppose it sounds good, but I don't know whether I would have enjoyed it, having my roof blown off my house as he did.
Yeah. It's an incredible thing that the memories of fathers. My father was in the Second World War also, and he rarely spoke about it too, Sean, unless he'd had a few drinks. But I guess, yes, wanting to hide it, perhaps push it away from their children, et cetera, et cetera. I think you make note in the book too, pull me up if I'm wrong, but your father and mother were different personalities, and your mother had been brought up in country South Australia.
Yes. Mum had a different, she had kind of a tough life herself in a different way to my father. She grew up in a house. It's always a good story whenever she tells it. Grew up in a house with no electricity, no inside plumbing, it was pretty basic. Kerosene lanterns would light the house, these sound positively Dickensian to my ears, but of course it was par the course for a country South Australian back in Mum's day. And I think one of the legacies of not wanting, with both my parents not really wanting to visit that upon us as children, they weren't that forthcoming in telling us the stories. Mum, Dad particularly, is that you get a sort of, particularly in Dad's case, you get a kind of remoteness. You might have experienced this yourself. Because it's forefront of, you know, our fathers' minds, because it was such a significant part of their lives, World War II, and because they don't want to talk about that, they don't kind of talk about anything else. So it was a bit hard to kind of reach my father, which I was able to do as an adult when it kind of would all make sense and be weighted properly. And I think that makes a big difference. I mean, as a result, we weren't a terribly demonstrative family in terms of communicating our love for each other. And how we did it was in comedy, with jokes and laughing. That's how we showed how close we were. And I think maybe that's why I am drawn to it. So if I'm going to write a book about it, I have to kind of tell that story in order for the audience to understand why it is so important to me, why it's almost like a it's a visceral thing that I'm just drawn to it. And I think that's why.
Actually, yeah, a good point too, Sean. And I was about to suggest that because of the imagination that was you had and you used your imagination, I guess, as a way of communicating, I suppose, and then we relate, I guess, a bit to your stories from your early school days, which are quite funny, but at the same time, there you are finding the best way to communicate was through comedy and making fun of the teachers, etc., was always guaranteed to get a good laugh. I suppose that was important for you to be able to achieve that. A lot of kids perhaps wouldn't communicate through comedy, but you chose that avenue. So it was good. One of the funniest things you said was when Tofty, the bus driver, gave your own valet service by dropping you off at your front door.
Yes, you wouldn't get that these days, would you? You wouldn't have public people in charge of public transport just deciding, oh, well, I don't need to follow the route. I'll just take this kid home. It's a bit of a walk for him. Yes, and the great thing was that bus driver was my mother's bus driver when she was at school. Again, you don't get that. Well, that's an Adelaide thing, maybe. Everybody knows each other. It was and is such a small world in Adelaide, which is quite comforting in a way. I mean, as you know, being from Adelaide, it doesn't take too much of a conversation with a stranger to work out that you have somebody in common in your lives. You know, it takes maybe two steps removed or something like that. And there's bound to be somebody that you both know.
It's so true. We had a conductor on our bus when we were kids coming home from school. We nicknamed him Dracula. But when my wife got home each day, I would say to her, did you see anyone you knew today, love? And the answer would always be yes, just about. Sean, recollections of your early school days. I mean, how you went, you said you went from being a dimwit to a solid C-grade student. Did that leave you with a sense of achievement?
Well, it did. I mean, it was quite important in our household to particularly, my mother's very good at school and could have, if she had had the opportunity, I think, gone on to further education, tertiary education, that sort of thing. In those days, though, I think the public service examination at the end of year 10 was probably the most that you could hope for if you'd come out of country, South Australia. So for me to not be a terribly stellar student, which is kind of a bit of a letdown, I think. She was very keen for me to excel at school or at least realise whatever potential I had. But it did take a while for things to fall into line. I don't know. I was never diagnosed as being dyslexic or anything, but it did take me a while to work out how to read words or letters, rather, that were in a row and then words that were in a row. These just appear to me as a big lump. And I could kind of pick them out individually, but I couldn't push them together and read a sentence. But at some point, I had a very good English teacher who kind of helped me, not directly, I guess. He just got me to stand up and speak a bit more. And at some point, all the tumblers aligned. Yes, there was a penny drop moment for me where it kind of all makes sense. And then I just instantly fell in love with language, and I still am in love with it, I guess. That's how I make my living.
Yeah, that's right. That's an important point too, Sean, when you go back to gaining confidence with the language through speaking the words and those words then making sense. But that ability took you perhaps beyond what a lot of people can do with the language. Quite ironic that they would be having trouble putting words together when viewing them on a page, and yet then converting them so brilliantly when standing up and speaking the language.
Yes, I think I could. I think I could cover for my inability to read by just kind of ad-libbing or tap dancing between the thoughts that I was expressing. And I still do that now. I think I still, you know, I lean into things. Mad as Hell, for example, is entirely on auto cue. Everything I do is, when I look down the barrel to the home audience, I am simply reading. And equally with the interviews that I do, I'm looking over the shoulder of my fellow actors, reading my lines. I haven't learned anything. But man, I can read now. I can read now, and it doesn't look like I'm reading. So I think maybe I'm just trying to impress my mother. That's what we all do.
Yeah. Did you see me today, Mum? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I'm over here, Mum. Look at me now.
That's right. You said that after law, your choices were journalism and wildlife parks management. Do you think you still would have become a comedian if you had been in the wildlife and parks or working for Murdoch or something?
Well, that's a good point. Yes, I hadn't thought of that. If I'd taken Plan B or Plan C, or, you know, just my marks weren't enough to get me into law, I could probably see a way of going from journalism into television presentation, comedy. I could do that. Yeah, but looking after wildlife monitoring the success or not of a national park, I can't quite see how I could segue from that into comedy. That would have been difficult.
That would be exactly right. The thing that comes out about the book Tripping Over Myself, Sean, to me, one of the strongest things was your tenaciousness. And without sometimes being aware of your own tenaciousness and being told, I think there was a guy, Patrick Cook, was it, or some, that told you about your writing?
Patrick gave me some very good advice. Patrick was a wonderful writer himself, and he told me a hard truth about my writing, that it was a bit derivative and that I shouldn't give up my day job. So I didn't. I went back to work for another couple of years and then decided, that's enough. I'm better now. I'm going to chance my arm and see if I can make it. But, you know, it's good to get, you know, there's no point being encouraged if the person doing the encouraging isn't being sincere. So I actually appreciate his bluntness.
It was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And the tenaciousness was, I mean, you just charged on through. It reminds me of when I was told I wasn't in the football squad, but I kept training until they told me to piss off. And you know, it's, I suppose, piss off, Ross, you're not in the squad. But that was at Mitcham in Adelaide. Andrew Denton interpreted a recurring dream of yours, I guess, as you feeling you didn't deserve the success you were getting. Which may, I suppose, be the same with a lot of us too, Sean. But can you relate to that today, about that feeling?
Well, the world of the world that I've chosen to earn my living in is one, you can come at it from any angle. You know, I've learned that over time, is that it is full of people who've come through various doors and windows in order to get where they are. Mm. There's no hierarchy, really. There's no pathway that everyone has to take. But at the time, I had this dream, and I'll recount the dream. Mm-hmm. It was that I was climbing up an enormous tower, but not using the stairs. I was in the walls, and I was sort of surreptitiously making my way up through this tower, but in the walls, like it was an Edgar Allan Poe story.
Yeah,
and
wow.
Andrew said, that's an interesting dream. He said, and his interpretation, as you've said, was that I felt that I didn't deserve to be climbing those stairs. And so I was doing it secretly or in an embarrassed way. And I think that's probably true. I wasn't at all confident despite my tenacity and despite my desperation to succeed. I guess I had that imposter syndrome that some of us have from time to time, when we think, at our lowest point, we think, I really just don't deserve to be here. There are others who are better, and indeed there are others who definitely were better. But since then, I've learned that there are no rules. You can do whatever you can do whatever you want, and if you look confident enough, that'll be enough.
How brilliant! And I think that may have been the dream it may have been a way of doing things the hard way too, by climbing up, by not using the stairs. But is it true that Philip Adams was largely responsible for you getting on the ABC by having a word to somebody?
Well, yes, we had talked about this. I was promoting a book, and he was the one that suggested to me, after we finished talking on Late Night Live, he said to me that I should try some political comedy, some news satire on the ABC, and suggested to me that he was going to have a word to the general manager. And I thought, well, that's very nice of him. I left it a couple of weeks. I didn't speak to Philip again about it, but I did contact Mark Scott, who was then the general manager, and he put me onto somebody else. And within about, I reckon it might have been 2 or 3 months, we had a series commissioned. And now I thanked Philip in the meantime, but he denies any knowledge. He says that he didn't talk to anybody. I have to sit him down and have the conversation with him, because somebody must have spoken to somebody. It couldn't have just been me ringing up Mark Scott. That doesn't make any sense. So I think Philip Adams is a kind of he's like the godfather. You know, he'll just make things happen. Won't make a big deal about it. But at some point, he's going to ring me and ask for a favour to be returned. I know it.
That's very godfather-like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Just a couple of final points to Sean. You were recording the SBS show, I think, Sean McAuliffe's Stairway to Heaven, and you found yourself sitting on a rock near the Kashmiri border, feeling homesick. Now, you speak about needing to contemplate, I guess, what's important in life. Was that a moment for you?
Absolutely. I think I was probably about trying to remember my age. I think I might have been early 50s, 53 perhaps, 53 or 54. And I'd gone through a TV program that took a lot out of me. And, you know, look, it's only a TV program, so it's not like I'm complaining too loudly. But I did wonder whether there's got to be something else. You know, there's got to be some other point to, you know, my life other than getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning and putting a stupid wig on. So of course, turned my quest for meaning into a television show. I thought I'd go to India, where a lot of people go to find themselves. So, yes, there I found myself on a rock on the Kashmiri border, told not to use a mobile phone. Don't use your mobile phone, they'll shoot you.
Oh, geez.
I think it's a satellite phone that you're calling an airstrike. Yeah, it was good. It was good. It was a good experience for me. Mm. And it kind of put things into perspective. And I guess I think the conclusion that I reached for me, which works for me, was not so much that there's another life beyond this one, but that you've got to make do with the one we've got, and you've got to give it meaning, I suppose. There's no meaning to be found. You actually have to work to give your life meaning. So for me, it's my family, it's you know, my children. That's the most important thing, and it seems like a very trite thing to trite observation to make, but I kind of needed reminding of that at that point in my life, and it's that stayed with me since. So I kind of got perspective and harmony on what I'm doing. As the road out ahead of me, Greg, grows shorter, I'm going to do as much with it as I can.
How brilliant. How brilliant. And I suppose finally that would lead to a stripping of the ego and indeed a notation about your favourite movie being Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life.
Great film, and it is all about duty, that film, and it's all about sacrifice. And the thing I love about that film is that there's a nobility from the, you know, from George Bailey, the character played by James Stewart. He doesn't want to be doing the things that he has to do, but he's such a good man that he does them anyway. Yeah. It's still such a great film, and the message in it is so wholesome, decent, and quite accurate. And the film came out about, from memory, probably 1943, 1940. No, it's 46. It was after
46,
the war.
46, yeah.
After the Second World War. If any of your readers haven't seen it, I would heartily recommend it. It's a film that stands up to this day. It's just such a beautiful story.
It's one of the best, Sean. It's one of the best. As is your contribution to Australian art and comedy, and indeed a book that takes us a step closer to understanding you. I suppose we're all in the process of understanding each other, but it helps us understand you. And coming from Adelaide, I relate to your big early parts of that book too. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Greg. Been very nice talking to you too. We're all a work in progress. You know, we just got to try and work it out, try and come to some conclusion before we're asked to leave the stage.
Yeah, wonderful. Thanks, Sean.